Hi again and welcome back to episode 3 of Kulturdenken, the podcast of the International Research Center for Cultural Studies from the Olfax Symposium in Vienna. I'm speaking with Sean Chu. Sean's books are basically classics in the sensory of smell studies. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Katerina.
Sean is professor of English at the University of California, Davis. His research explores 19th and 20th century U.S. literature, Asian diaspora and race studies, cultural geography, sensory studies, and environmental humanities. His recent work examines the role of affection and atmosphere in shaping social and spatial inequalities, as well as in artistic and political practices. He is currently completing a manuscript on olfactory worldmaking, and he is the author of the monographs Air Conditioning and The Smell of Risk.
Yeah, so The Smell of Risk was, you know, a 2020 book in which I focus on smell as a sensory capacity for perceiving and communicating about environmental toxicity, right? So especially toxic air, which I think addresses both the way in which toxicity is often invisible and the like really powerful ways in which people respond to smells, right? But also really contentious ways. So that, you know, often like scientists will kind of respond, or like especially corporate scientists, right, that like just because one can smell something in the air doesn't mean that it's harmful. So there's a lot of kind of like political contestation of the role of smells, which is part of what I'm interested in. I'm interested in how atmosphere both materially and affectively conditions people, right, and affects people unevenly. So it has this kind of like really insidious force, and some of the ways in which that happens, I think, are through smell, right? So the distribution of different kinds of smells, but also like the different ways in which smell gets recognized or stigmatized as a mode of knowledge at all, right? And then also in temperature, right? Which is not just atmospheric, but that was kind of like my point of entry into thinking about temperature, but it kind of took me into, you know, other things like metabolics or clothing, yeah, like sun exposure, wind, things like this.
Sean uses the term olfactory colonization to describe how colonial projects control and devalue smell and smellscapes within broader systems of domination. This occurs through an ideology of deodorization that dismisses smell as too bodily or subjective, and through material transformations of smellscapes via war, industry, agriculture, tourism, and other environmental changes. These processes erode indigenous olfactory knowledge and relations, enabling the remaking of land, air, and social space while concealing sensory and epistemic violence. In his talk at the Olfac conference, Sean is trying to offer the idea of smelling in the past conditional mood, which is first of all a grammatical mood which sets the focus on what could have been or what could have happened.
So in my talk, I was trying to offer the idea of smelling in the past conditional mood, right? So as against a kind of positive historical tendency to focus on trying to recover historical smells or recover evidence of how historical people experienced smell, kind of like as it actually was smelled, right? I mean, that approach is really important, but I think that, and very influential in heritage studies especially, right? This kind of attempt to reconstruct historical smells and present them to the public. It gets a certain kind of public attention, but I think it tends to take for granted the completeness and the kind of truth of the archive.
Smell, as Sean shows, has recently been at the center of major developments in the fields of heritage studies and sensory history. One example of a recreated historical scent is the interior of Queen Elizabeth's beloved Rover P5B car. But Sean also states,
it's relatively uncritical about the limitations of the archive, the way in which it privileges certain olfactory perspectives. We could say like the white, patriarchal, Eurocentric nose. And also the way that it glosses over, therefore, you know, a whole range of different kinds of olfactory experiences and meanings, as well as the relationships that they might open up. between different people, different groups, humans and non-humans. So thinking about smell in the past conditional mood, which is an idea that I take from Lisa Lowe's really influential book, The Intimacies of Four Continents, where she talks about kind of approaching historical archives in this kind of past conditional mood.
Lisa Lowe's book, The Intimacies of Four Continents, traces a critical history of liberalism and its hidden intimacies by examining widely dispersed colonial archives and regions. In his presentation, Sean quotes what Lowe proposes.
Quote, "A past conditional temporality through which I suggest it is possible to conceive the past not as fixed or settled, not as inaugurating the temporality into which our present falls, but as a configuration of multiple contingent possibilities, all present yet none inevitable. The past conditional temporality of what could have been symbolizes a space of attention that holds at once the positive objects and methods respected by modern history and social science, as well as the inquiries into connections and convergences rendered unavailable by those methods. It allows us to revisit times of historical contingency and possibility to consider alternatives that may have been unthought in those times and might otherwise remain so now, in order to imagine different futures for what lies ahead."
Sean explains that this idea allows us to approach olfactory questions and issues more speculatively.
So thinking beyond a positivist approach and a focus on kind of like relatively, quote, hard evidence. And so I turn to works of literature and art that are speculative in their method for just kind of like thinking with them in these speculative ways. And the examples that I look at are Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, which is largely a realist novel, but also has, you know, numerous magical realist elements. Most prominently, the kind of story of the flying African, which has been the focus of a lot of the scholarship on the novel. But I focus attention as on this kind of alternative way of becoming atmospheric, right? So not flying men, but working with smells, with roots, kind of domestic care work, reproductive labor. So more, let's say, like Black feminist modes of working with and in the air. So I look at this sweet ginger smell that she describes really evocatively for, you know, numerous paragraphs and that crops up throughout the novel in scenes that focus on the work of a conjure woman, so the character Pilot, and other kind of like Black matriarch figures, in order to think about like atmospheres of care, right, that are extended across generations and connect the geographies that they inhabit with ancestral communities, both in the South and in Africa.
The flying African, as Sean explains, is a folkloric figure linked to Igbo Landing, where a group of Igbo captives, having seized control of their slave ship, entered a stream after it ran aground in Georgia. Enslaved West Africans and their descendants in the region believed that these captives either flew or were carried by the water back to their homeland. From this history, the figure of the flying African emerges as a metaphor of both refusal and transcendence, evoking the enduring ties between the African diaspora and their ancestral places and cultures. In the final scene of Toni Morrison's book, the protagonist Milkman Dead leaps off a cliff believing that he will take flight. That is, after Milkman learns towards the end of his quest for self-knowledge, that his ancestor Solomon was among the flying Africans who flew back to Africa to escape from slavery. In his presentation, Sean states that the titular Song of Solomon does not center the flying African so much as those he leaves behind, quote,
"O Solomon, don't leave me here, cotton balls to choke me, Solomon done fly, Solomon done gone." By juxtaposing the archetype of flight with the suffering and sorrow of the women and children left behind, Morrison offers a critical perspective on flight and the freedom of mobility as techniques of survival disproportionately available to able-bodied Black men who are willing to leave kin and community obligations behind. At the heart of the novel, then, is the question, how can one ride the air, that's a quote from the novel, without leaving loved ones behind? Song of Solomon explores smell as an alternative to flight, another means of becoming atmospheric. If flight is Milkman's patriarchal inheritance, scent is frequently associated with the novel's women, along with the domestic spaces they inhabit and the acts of care they perform. Milkman's aunt, Pilot, becomes an important mentor as he gains some measure of independence from his father's devotion to bourgeois accumulation. Educated by a migrant root worker and described by several critics as a conjure woman, Pilot lives with her daughter and granddaughter in an unkempt yet welcoming house suffused with a distinctive odor. Both Pilot and her house are introduced through olfactory impressions. Her brother disparages her, quote, sickening smell, and her house is described as, quote, shiny and brown with a smell. Although this smell violates deodorized bourgeois norms, Milkman learns that its main conceptions are the pine trees near Pilot's house and the fermenting wine she produces to support her family. There's something inexplicably alluring about the smell. Milkman spends hours in the house listening to Pilot talk because, quote, the piney, winey smell was narcotic.
Sean also draws attention to the fact that not all the smells in the book can be traced to physical sources.
Quote, on autumn nights in some parts of the city, the wind from the lake brings a sweetish smell to shore, an odor like crystallized ginger or sweet iced tea with a dark clove floating in it. There is no explanation for the smell either, since the lake on September 19th, 1963 was so full of mill refuse and the chemical wastes of a plastic manufacturer that the hair of the willows that stood near the shore was thin and pale, end quote. Here, Morrison acknowledges the lakeside air filled with industrial pollutants as a vehicle of environmental slow violence that affects humans and non-humans alike. But while the willow's thinning hair indicates how vulnerable living beings are to toxic harm, the focus of this passage is on another inexplicable presence in the air, the elusive sweetish smell like crystallized ginger or sweet iced tea with a dark clove, exceeds the issue of environmental toxicity, drawing our attention instead to materials, ginger, sugar, tea, and cloves, whose circulation and intermixture were bound up with the histories of slavery and empire.
The smell of ginger also contains historical tensions that have more positive resonances, as Sean states further in his presentation.
Although it was not an inherently or exclusively African material, ginger was eventually incorporated into local culinary health and spiritual practice on both sides of the Atlantic. Like other roots incorporated into African syncretic practices, ginger is also an apt metaphor for rootedness or connection with ancestral lands, including Africa, the Caribbean, and for those who moved during the Great Migration, the South. At the same time, like the concept of diaspora, which refers to the sowing of seeds, often by the wind, the scent of ginger holds together the concepts of rootedness and volatilized mobility, quote, the air that could have come straight from a marketplace in Accra. Song of Solomon then follows this ginger sugar smell onto shore, where it contributes to the production of a sensory and social divide. Morrison details a smellscape inflected by architecture, infrastructure, and a complex social geography that separates the wealthy people living near the lake from the south side, whose disproportionately black residents cannot afford air conditioning. Quote, yet there was this heavy spice-sweet smell that made you think of the east and striped tents and the sha-sha-sha of leg bracelets. The people who lived near the lake hadn't noticed the smell for a long time now because when air conditioners came, they shut their windows and slept a light surface sleep under the motor's drone. So the ginger sugar blew unnoticed through the streets, around the trees, over roofs, until thinned out and weakened a little, it reached Southside. There, where some houses didn't even have screens, let alone air conditioners, the windows were thrown wide open to whatever the night had to offer. And there the ginger smell was sharp, sharp enough to distort dreams and make the sleeper believe the things he hungered for were right at hand. To the Southside residents who were awake on such nights, it gave all their thoughts and activity a quality of being both intimate and far away. The two men standing near the pines on Darling Street, right near the brown house where wine drinkers went, could smell the air, but they didn't think of ginger. Each thought it was the way freedom smelled, or justice, or luxury, or vengeance, end quote.
In contrast to the deodorized, climate-controlled air of wealthy homes, the open windows of the simple residences in the South expose inhabitants to both industrial toxins and evocative diasporic scents, like the ginger, that blur boundaries of space, memory, and desire. Toni Morrison uses this shifting olfactory perception to show how the sweet ginger smell stirs Milkman's unconscious longing for origin, setting in motion his journey towards ancestral discovery. Sean summarizes.
If flight is the novel's most salient aerial motif, smell lingers through its background as an airborne medium of memory, affect, and Black feminist care. Although the novel never offers a literal explanation for the sweet ginger scent that emanates from the lake over Mercy, Michigan, it repeatedly associates the scent with the everyday lives of Pilot and other Black women. Smell attunes us not only to the body in flight, but to the aerial medium that holds and sustains flight. Throughout the novel, the sweet scent of ginger, a root grounded in women's everyday practices of care and conjure and volatilized into airborne matter, offers another model for surrendering to the air and riding its currents of affect and polychronic resonance, a sensuous mode of access to the possibilities inherent in the atmosphere as a medium of care.
Toni Morrison's book is one example Sean works with. Then he also looks at Candace Lynn's installation Swamp Fett, exhibited in New Orleans in 2021 and 22. The gallery was suffused with a scent of dried shrimp and decaying vermin, which was also infused into a suit of sculptures that were made to resemble dead creatures atop enormous blocks of what looked like marbled meat.
Swamp Fat is about a community of Filipino sailors who abandoned their ships where they were working or forced to work under exploitative conditions and started up a fishing and shrimping community in Louisiana, so in the swamps of Louisiana. And so she's kind of commemorating that community, but not really in a way that's like trying to claim recognition for its humanness or for its like long, you know, labors in the service of like American industry, right? But rather thinking about it as a site of interspecies intimacy between, you know, the fishermen and various non-human creatures, as well as cross-racial kinds of solidarity between the fishermen. And she talks about Maroon fugitive slaves who are reportedly joined the community, Chinese who, you know, also reportedly lived among and worked among that community.
St. Malo, the Filipino community in the Louisiana swamps, was first brought to national attention in 1883, when Harper's Weekly sent the writer Lafcadio Hearn to investigate the village's, quote, amphibious existence, unquote. Sean explains in his presentation.
Beginning with a spurious rumor about, quote, a ghastly Chinese colony in the reedy swamps, Hearn casts the swamp and its racialized inhabitants in Gothic terms. For Hearn and his primarily white middle-class readers, St. Malo was, quote, dark, ruined, rotted, and spectral. He describes the Filipino villagers in non-human terms, quote, supple as freshwater eels. There's houses looming over the marsh, quote, like cranes watching for scaly prey. Despite its limitations, Hearn's sketch is one of the few surviving firsthand accounts of the settlement, which was destroyed by a hurricane in 1915. In recent years, Filipino historians have rejected Hearn's primitivist perspective by reframing the village as a site that establishes the long historical presence of Filipino settlers and their contributions to its economy. Recovery narratives focused on shoring up Filipino-American heritage seek to humanize St. Malo's inhabitants by making claims for local and national belonging. So this is an example of one. Instead of working to humanize the fishermen's relationship to their locale, Lynn's installation situates the fishermen amid the myriad messy interactions that make up swamp ecologies. The blended scent of shrimp and decaying vermin recasts the swamp as a site of lively, unruly entanglements. To be swamped is to be overwhelmed with water or excess in a way that unsettles conventional ideals of solidity and temporal progression. Lynn's term, swamp fat, reframes the swamp as a space of excess or abundance, and not just for its human inhabitants. Where Hearn emphasizes the village's regional isolation, Lynn's shrimp scent highlights St. Malo's pivotal role in producing dried shrimp for both the regional economy, where it became a vital ingredient in Creole cuisine, and in the global market. By shaping clay from St. Malo into blocks of marbled meat, Lynn also foregrounds the multiple histories of animal rendering and racialized labor that converge in and around the village. Noting that St. Malo's fishermen were, quote, joined by Chinese indentured coolie laborers and fugitive slaves, Lynn frames the village as an experimental site for cross-racial kinship as well as interspecies intimacies. The installation's meat-like scagliola blocks are also intended to invoke the slaughterhouse cases, a key Supreme Court ruling from 1873 on the 14th Amendment, in which a group of white butchers sought to exclude black and other non-white butchers from the industry. Instead of presenting dried shrimp as a scent that evokes rarefied notions of, quote, Asian American identity, Swamp Fat reanimates it in relation with other materials and other scenes of racialized labor. What kinds of proximities, differences, and potential grounds for solidarity existed and may still exist between Black and Asian diasporic workers who have been racialized in part through their domestic and occupational proximities to non-human animals? Without trying to fully recover or monumentalize these stories, Lynn resuscitates their webs of cross-racial and interspecies relation. The shrimp and its scent, along with clay sourced from St. Malo, hold memories of the feet that crushed them in the village's ritualized shrimp dance.
Candace Lynn also asks people to smear the shrimp fat on themselves. Sean elaborates on this idea.
Yes, so she made a balm out of the mixed smells of dried shrimp and decaying vermin, and the vermin were sourced from dead animals gifted to her by her cat, and then infused it into lard. That was the balm. And then she put it into these sculptures of dead swamp creatures, right? So like a small caiman or an alligator-like creature, like a reptile, a frog. And they're kind of open, and visitors could take some of the balm and, you know, rub it on themselves and leave the exhibition wearing it. And I think partly it invites visitors to kind of like decide, right? Like, how intimate do they want to be with the smell that many would have, you know, probably found pretty disturbing and uncomfortable. Others might have actually been quite familiar with the, well, maybe with both sides of it, but, you know, like the culinary, like this dried shrimp might be comforting for people who relate to it as a kind of ingredient in comfort foods that they grew up with. Right. So Asian diasporic people, people who grew up eating Creole cuisine. But at the same time, you know, there's also the smell of decaying vermin. Right. So like this idea of like decomposition. And so, yeah, like how intimate do you want to be with this? Do you want to kind of like become part of the artwork or vice versa? Yeah, like become another medium for kind of bringing it into or out of the gallery into the world. As, you know, scholars of smell and perfumers know, smells change when people wear them, right? So it actually like adds another dimension of unpredictability and this kind of unruly mixture, right, to the work when people who already have different like bodily chemical compositions, temperatures, et cetera, that like they're going to, you know, put it on and create these new olfactory mixtures if they decide to do so. And she does talk about it as a kind of protective balm. And I was thinking of it, I guess it raises the question of like, what does this protect against, right? Like, because people, I mean, miasma theory always thought of the smell of decomposition as what we needed to protect against.
The so-called miasma theory held that diseases like cholera and plague spread through bad air from decay and filth rather than microbes, linking illnesses to foul smells and poor sanitation. Though later disproven, it inspired major urban cleanliness and sanitation reforms. The smell that people take back from Candace Lynn's exhibition wards against something else, like Sean elaborates.
So I think it protects against racialized discourses of purity, right? And like classist discourses of purity. But also, yeah, like the fantasy of a kind of like impervious body And most of all, this idea of colonial unknowing, right, which is a term from an influential essay by Juliana Hupeggies, Manu Vimalasiri, and Alyosha Goldstein. And it's really thinking about how colonialism supports itself and reproduces itself through regimes of unknowing, right? And also kind of like by making things very like impossible or unavailable to the senses. So by shutting down the sense of smell, discrediting it as a source of knowledge, imposing like regimes of deodorization, it makes it very difficult for, say, you know, one example would be for racialized migrants, right, to access their collective memories through smell the way that, you know, like Proust's Madeleine.
In Marcel Proust's novel À la recherche du temps perdu, the Madeleine episode describes how tasting a small, shell-shaped cake dipped in tea suddenly and vividly brings back the narrator's childhood memories of Sundays in the town where he grew up. This involuntary rush of memory, triggered by taste and smell rather than deliberate effort, becomes a model of how the past survives in sensory impressions and can unexpectedly resurface, opening the way for the whole narrative of lost time to unfold.
One can go, at least where I live in the U.S., to many cafes or grocery stores and get a Madeleine, smell it, get some tea, like some lime blossom tea. But dried shrimp, I mean, now it's much more familiar, but it's still, or much more common, but I think it's still culturally much more stigmatized, right? And there are other materials, like I've written about mustard oil, right, which was prohibited in Europe and North America for a while because of its supposed health effects, although we could think about the health effects of, you know, all kinds of things that are in all kinds of widely accepted and beloved foods, that's also something that, you know, people in Southeast Asia, South Asia are very familiar with and then were then like unable to access when they were living in these countries.
In the end, I'm asking Sean, does the confrontation with the uncomfortable, or probably with the unconscious through smell, might probably help to unlearn the legacies of colonial capitalism?
This idea of kind of like a disgust reaction, right, is like, you know, neurologically encoded into the brain, and then cultural components get overlaid on it. So that we have this like really visceral response that's tied to, you know, human and presumably also many non-human creatures, like impulses of disease avoidance, right? But then that gets kind of like misrecognized, or, you know, like we tend to misrecognize culturally stigmatized smells as, you know, threats that have like that kind of disease association with it. So I do think that the way that olfactory aesthetics, right, whether it's artworks or narratives, can defamiliarize our sense of smell or denaturalize it, that can kind of, I mean, partly it can create critical distance, as many have argued, but I think it can also kind of create new conditions for smelling, right, or new, in the Candace Lynn case, kind of like new smells altogether that might kind of lead us in other directions. And that, I mean, I guess I'm partly interested in the idea not only of kind of critiquing olfactory violence, but these artworks that are really interested in like olfactory, like erotics or appeal, or the way that like smell can kind of like move us, right? So yeah, like what other kinds of relationships and relations can smell move us towards? I think that in other cases, like the Toni Morrison case, it's calling towards these kind of like ancestral knowledges and perhaps a kind of like calling towards a kind of acknowledgement of the just like really essential and, you know, largely derecognized work of reproductive labor, right, that the women in the novel have been doing all along.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
This was Sean Xu about olfactory ecologies in the past conditional at the Olfax Symposium in Vienna for Kulturdenken, the podcast of the IFK. Thanks for listening.